Welcome to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. Today, I have Sebastian Sitko on as a repeat guest on the show. Sebastian, welcome back. How are you doing?
Many thanks for your invitation, Michael. It's always a pleasure to come here to discuss current science on triathlon, cycling, and on other endurance sports. Yeah.
It's great to have you. Can you, for newer listeners who didn't listen to the previous episode, I actually didn't check before when it was we actually recorded, but probably at least a couple of years ago, give the listeners a 1 minute recap of who you are.
Yeah, so I'm basically a professor of sports science at the University of Zaragoza, which is located in the north of Spain. I'm also a researcher here, and I also have my own business where I coach mainly cyclists, specifically road cyclists, but some triathletes and trail runners. And, you know, I work with both pro and amateur athletes.
All right, great. And what is your research focus? What type of research have you been doing yourself?
In general, we are researching performance in road cycling and particularly all that can be related to power-based training.
Yeah. And yeah, you have your book there for people watching on YouTube. They can see your book next to you, Cycling 2.0. So some of the topics we discuss here today are inspired a bit from chapters you have in your book. But then in general, we will also discuss a lot of the science and practice, the how to go from one to the other, how they connect, and some specific topics, some maybe more meta topics about how to think about science in the practical aspects of training and coaching. So with that, an interesting question that I wanted to start with is, what for you are the top three specific findings from sport science that have most influenced you as a coach?
I will answer with three different types of studies that influenced me quite a bit. First, we'll have this retrospective longitudinal studies that assess the evolution of performance of, you know, top performing athletes. As an example, we have papers of some of my colleagues like Fred Grapp from France, who showed us the evolution of the famous cyclist Thibaut Pinot since he was a junior cyclist to a podium finisher in the Tour de France. Also, my colleague from Italy, Gabriele Gallo, who has shown us the characteristics of training of 5 podium finishers in Grand Tours. So these kind of studies are very interesting because there we can see what top performers are currently doing and what can we imitate, and also what we shouldn't be imitating as of now. Then the second type of study would be we'll talk about that later, I guess, but the head-to-head comparisons between interventions. So for example, when you want to compare on-bike strength training versus off-the-bike strength training, what happens? So this kind of studies provide very interesting data specifically for short-term interventions. And finally, and this is not discussed a lot in sports science, but the studies that have no positive results or negative results are also very interesting because they show us, you know, the ways that we shouldn't follow, at least as of now, because you may spend a lot of money and time there and, you know, obtain 0 results. So, you know, these 3 different topics.
Yeah, and on that last one, I think it's also interesting that we have discussed previously in other episodes on the podcast about probably for every study that is published with a null result, there are quite a few that are still in the drawers and that were never published but also had null results. So even one null result can be quite powerful if it's a topic that has only a few studies published. But I am going to challenge you to be a bit more specific on the first one. I think is a very specific example of that kind of longitudinal following of athletes. But in terms of a type of intervention study, pick an example that you think that, well, this is something that really has influenced you and that you are using in your coaching. And same thing with the null results studies, an example from there of something that for now you're not using because of that.
Yeah, As for the last example, for instance, I got published a study like 2 years ago about core strength training for cyclists, which was a negative result. We showed that there is zero performance benefit from core strength training. And, you know, that's an interesting example of a negative outcome that models your approach to training, because at the end of the day, you will discuss that later, I guess, but you want to make the most out of the time, specifically with amateur athletes. You want to make the most out of the time they have available. So you are not going to waste their time on interventions that, as it is shown currently, seem to not work so well. No? So this, I think that would be a great example. And also, I think that I have told you the studies by Gabriele, by Frederick Grubb with Pinot. It's interesting because you can see that very different approaches to training and specifically to periodization may result in similar performance outcomes. Thus, in this case, a podium finish on a Grand Tour. So this models your approach to training because shows you that there is no one specific way that you can achieve great results, but you must be very careful that the program you want to suggest the athlete must be as good as possible for this specific athlete. And that requires both experience and also time working with the athlete to know him quite well.
Yeah. And on that note, and if we're talking about the Thibaut Pinots of the world, but as you said there, the example with the core training, with amateur athletes, you have to be really careful with, or you basically want your training to be time efficient because there's always a time limitation, even if it's bigger for some athlete than it is for others. But there's also that aspect of the amateur athlete not being as well trained as the pro athlete, not having the same deep depth of fitness. So do you think that there are some things that amateur athletes should absolutely not copy or, let's say, learn from what we hear about elite training? For example, on this podcast, I've had lots of coaches and athletes from that world, but are there things that athletes should be really careful with when it comes to that sort of information?
I think that there is one very common mistake, and it's the fact that many amateur, especially the very proficient amateur athletes, are trying to recreate the same training characteristics, say volume, intensity, or total load, as the pros. And the problem here is that they cannot recreate the off the bike or off the sport world. So the context changes a lot. And if there's one significant difference between what a coach can do with a pro athlete and an amateur athlete, is the monitoring of training load. Because we know with a pro athlete that once he has finished his training, there is more or less, that's it. But in an amateur world, this guy will normally go 8 hours to the office, work in a factory, and then will have to play with his children for 2 hours, etc. And it's very difficult to monitor that. So if this guy tries to imitate the contextual specifics of what we do with the pros, normally will be burnout and quite fast.
Yeah. So what is the practical takeaway there? Should you, if you have a certain amount of hours available, should you not even use all of those hours, or should you use them, but you need to dial down the how much, do less load than you think that you can handle within that time? What are the practical takeaways?
Well, there are several takes. You know, you can monitor your recovery, but in general, it's not that common that an amateur athlete can perform 25 hours of training per week and still go 8 hours per day to work. No, so that's not what I encounter normally. So normally you will have a guy who can train 10, 12, 14 hours per week and is trying to. For example, I have seen some screenshots from training peaks of some World Tour riders, and you know, you can see a CTL of 155 or 160 during the Tour de France, and there are people people discussing this on forums, trying to reach that level with their everyday job and their family and their background, etc. And you know, of course, if they insist, they will be able to reach that CTL, but at which cost? Yeah. I'm not even talking here about the cost in terms of physical readiness for the next training sessions. I'm talking here about the social context, the family context, the work context, at which cost you will be able to recreate what the pros do. But then again, if you try to recreate that with a normal job and normal socioeconomic life, you will get burned.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one solution is to do a lot of swimming, and especially swimming with pull buoy and paddles. That can really accumulate false training load, false CTL very quickly. But no, I completely get what you're saying, and that's, yeah. I mean, it's pretty obvious though to not copy exactly the volume that the pros are doing. Is there something that is more on a more detailed level? Maybe something that where amateurs accept that, okay, I have my 10-15 hours, and so that's what I play with. But they're trying to maybe recreate. For example, here's an example. In 2022, there was a big, I think, trend in triathlon about doing a lot of lactate testing, especially during training, because the Norwegian triathletes were so successful and showing a lot of that on social media. And I think that has faded away a lot since. But that's probably an example where I'm not saying that it's the wrong thing for the top Norwegian athletes to do that. They did it for a reason and it clearly worked very well for them. But I wouldn't recommend amateur athletes to do that as much, or like to a very limited scale for certain athletes. There are some contexts where it can be useful, but that's an example that I think of where copying the pros is probably not the way to go.
Well, I think here we have to differentiate between the empirical context of what pro coaches are doing while experimenting, which is what you will normally see the pros do, and then the scientific context, which is normally relatable to things that have been quite tested and are quite conservative. So there are people who will tell you that, you know, the coaching world is 10 years ahead of the scientific world in terms of progress. I disagree with that, because it may be true for, you know, experimenting stuff, but that doesn't mean that it works. In fact, I would say that from what I have experimented with the pros, you know, it's like throwing things against a wall and see whether something sticks. And maybe we end up implementing totally like 20 or 30% of everything we try. So if you try to keep up to date and try everything, you know, we had the same with the ketones. We had the same with the torque training on bike. So there are like interventions that are trends. But, you know, if you try to see 5 years ahead in time, you will see that they no longer stick. So I like to say that for the conservative athlete who wants to do quite few things, but be sure that what he does is quite accurate, the scientific context is much better than the empirical context, because at the end of the day, we stick with what we believe quite firmly that it works. No? And it may be some years, behind in time, but it doesn't matter.
What do you think those, if you pick a few things that you would say that we know from science that it works, what are some examples of that?
Well, I think that something as simple as modeling training with a triphasic model, which has been around for more than 50 years now, works as good as trying to divide your prescription by training zones or by power zones and it has been proven with quite easy to test thresholds tested in the laboratory. Okay. So you have two thresholds, you test them and you divide your training in these three zones. With that, you will obtain at least what has been shown by science to date. Very similar results to what you will obtain by complicating things quite a bit more. No? So, you know, it's very graphical and it's very nice to the athlete to see that I have been 1 hour and 20 minutes in zone two, but the truth is that we do not know to date whether staying just below zone two or just above zone two or in zone three produces any different stimulus and adaptations than, you know, being 15 watts below or above. So I think this is quite a concept which is quite simple, which has been proven 50 years ago and it still works to date. This is just an example.
Yeah, but don't you think that if you have somebody with an, let's say an LT1 of 200 watts and an LT2 of 270 watts, just for example, for an amateur athlete, then don't you think there's a difference if they ride at in their zone two in a three zone model at 210 watts or they do it at 260 watts? Both would be in zone two.
In terms of long term adaptations, as far as we know, there's no difference.
And is there a lot of is there enough long-term studies to show that? Because that, I think, is often the limiter in science with a lack of long-term studies.
Yes, but that kind of limitation is what you will obtain with any kind of study besides medicine, you know, in which there is a pharma companies behind the studies which can afford to pay for 3-year, you know, studies. Because at the end of the day, all sports science studies are funded by the scientists themselves. I have paid for most of my studies.
Yeah.
So, of course, I would like to have like 300 subjects, test them for 12 months and see what happens. And, you know, that would be my perfect PhD, you know, to test 1 year of training at different training zones and see what happens at the muscular level, at the cardiac level, at the lung level, to see whether there are significant differences, no? I have my theories, but but this isn't economically possible, in at least in nowadays world, which, you know, it's not a first necessity, you know, sports science. So it's logical that there is no money invested, and whatever you do it from your heart, but not by, you know, economic, you know, interest.
Yeah, yeah. Is there something else, something you think that people, where people misapply research findings in practice? So maybe what I mean is people think that the research says one thing when it maybe doesn't say that. It might be, yeah, it might not be the opposite, but it's not quite what the research is actually saying.
Well, I think that in general, there's an increasing amount of people who are reading research, which is quite good. But the problem is that that is not accompanied by a capability to understand what you're reading, specifically statistics, there is a problem which I encounter normally, which is a direct interpretation of what you're reading. So for instance, last year we had a very interesting study from a Spanish lab in which, you know, they compared people doing on-bike resistance training versus off-bike resistance training, okay? And if you read the title of the study and even the abstract, it says basically it is equal, okay? On-bike versus off-bike resistance training is equal. And you say, okay, that's perfect. And an amateur reads that, he thinks that he has read the study, and he says, okay, I don't need to go to the gym. If it's equal, I will stay doing torque intervals on my bike, and that's okay. But if you start reading the study, first you see that the sample is quite small, etc., but they have just compared doing 5 or 6 squats versus 6 pedaling actions during climbing, okay, on the bike, and that resulted in similar performance outcomes. Okay,
yep.
This is a head-to-head comparison, which is what we must do in science. Okay, because you cannot compare a full strength training session in the gym versus one specific, you know, torque interval. That's not how it works. But if you try to implement that literally, you know, that's not the reality of training. Yeah, I know nobody who goes to the gym to strength train and do 5 of 6 squats and go and calls it a day. And people will do, you know, several different exercises, etc. And if you end reading the paper and say, okay, that's equal, but the fact is that you probably won't get the same adaptations at the level of bone tissue, which is very important if the only sport you are doing in your life is bicycling, and you probably won't get the same adaptations in terms of injury risk prevention because you are not working with your antagonist muscles, etc. So, you know, the literal interpretation of papers may result in these kind of outcomes.
And what do you think is the most prominent example of this? Because you mentioned that study that you mentioned is maybe not the most common example of it if it was only released last year. And so does anything come to mind where a super common example of where a lot of people go wrong?
Well, in the last 5 years, you can see lots of people, you know, attempting to the ingestion of incremental amounts of carbohydrates during exercise, for example, because the pros are doing it, okay? Of course, if your zone 2 training is at 300 watts, and you are burning 1,300 calories per hour of exercise, and most of this is carbohydrates, and you train specifically your digestion to, you know, tolerate that, You may even need that. That's okay. But the problem is that the guys who are trying to recreate that are guys who are you know, riding at 180 watts and are burning 700 calories per hour. Okay. So this is a quite obvious example of, you know, like attempting to do what has been tested in the pros, but this is a completely different population of your group or what is intended for your group. Okay.
Yeah. No, that's a good example. Thank you to our friends at Precision Fuel Hydration. Whether you're chasing podiums and PBs or lining up for your first long endurance event, Precision Fuel Hydration give you the tools to fuel and hydrate confidently with a bunch of free educational resources, as well as the best carbohydrate and electrolyte products on the market. They have electrolyte products that you can match to how salty your sweat is, and amazing carbohydrate products like the Flow Gel, the PF30, PF90, and the caffeinated PF30, plus drink mixes with and without electrolytes. They also have extremely tasty energy chews and their chew bars that really taste amazingly. I recommend keeping these in a locked cupboard so that you don't consume them all outside of training. Go to precisionfuelhydration.com and enter TTS2026 at checkout to get 15% off your first order. And leaving the science for a moment, just thinking about what people do in the real world in endurance sports, in cycling, is there something you think is widely believed to be true about endurance training that you believe is wrong or misunderstood in some way?
I think that the relative importance of weight is, you know, is believed to be much more important than it really is. But you need some context here. So, of course, if you are 10 kg overweight and this overweight is because of body fat, yeah, of course, you will be slower, either running or cycling, whatever. But in cycling, for example, this has been corrected in the last years, but in 2015, 2017, if you took a look at the riders, there was like extreme leanness, okay? But we are talking also about muscle mass here, okay? So complete leanness, no? You are combining like 4% body fat with, you know, muscle wasting, so zero muscle mass. And what I want to tell here is that it doesn't matter that much if you weigh 2 or 3 kg more, if this is based on muscle mass that will help you in your sport, okay? Either running or especially cycling. Even cycling uphill, if you have more muscle mass that will help you in the pedaling action, normally you will produce more absolute power, okay? If you have more absolute power, you have more power to fight the aero restriction, okay? Which when you are climbing quite well, maybe quite significant, okay? The power that you need to overcome the air resistance. So a rider that is a little bit heavier needs a lower watt per kilo to ride at the same speed, even when uphill climbing, than a rider that is a lower weight, okay? So, you know, the message here is don't obsess with weight. No, if you want to obsess with something, try to create the amount of muscle mass that allows you to produce your best power. Okay, yep. It doesn't matter if that results in 3 kilos more. Okay,
yeah, no, I think that's a good point. Moving on to a few specific topics that I want to discuss from the perspective of trying to square both the science and the practice side of things, starting with periodization. What do you think? Is there strong evidence for any periodization models or various different ones? No periodization model has strong scientific evidence. And what do you think then about how the scientific world or scientific findings, how they compare to what is actually practiced in the real world?
Well, first of all, your first question, as far as I know, there is no one specific model that, you know, results in better outcomes consistently, okay? But the next answer would be, it's very difficult to test for it because most of the evidence we have is retrospective, okay? But even in that case, we have very nice papers. For example, I remember one with two gold medalists in rowing in 4 years apart, okay, which, you know, their training distribution was periodization was assessed, and they saw that they had like completely different periodizations, and both, you know, won gold 4 years apart. So you know, that's a graphic example, no? But
what were the different, how would you describe the two different models that they used?
One was predominantly pyramidal, and the other one was mostly truss hop training. Yeah. Mm.
So that's more in terms of the training intensity distribution rather than the periodization itself.
Yeah, and when we talk about ATR blocks or conventional periodization, it's almost similar. In the end, you will always get the same result, which is most of them spent most of the time at easy intensities. Either at the start of the season or at the end of the season, we had that with, you know, several years ago with Team Sky, which they attempted, you know, for several years like a reverse periodization. But at the end of the day, you will have, if you assess it longitudinally, you will have most of the time at easy intensity and, you know, specific blocks of high intensity performed in ideal conditions.
Yeah. I think that the paper you mentioned by Gabriele Gallo with, was it a Giro podium finishers?
Giro and Tour, yeah.
Giro and Tour, yeah. That it was very good and showed a bit those intensity blocks that you mentioned. And in cycling, in professional cycling, how that is often related to just racing blocks. And
What was surprising in that paper is that if you took a look at the specifics, you would see that I think there were five riders assessed there, and three of them never performed strength training in the gym, and the other two just in the pre-season. Okay. Mm-hmm. That was quite surprising for me. And another, you know, specific that was quite surprising was the amount of the average training volume per week during the year was less than 17 hours. Which for me at that level was quite surprising. Yeah,
definitely. What do you think then about periodization in practice? How do you think about periodization as a coach?
Well, first of all, you must ask yourself, what are your objectives? So it's not the same if you have one, two, or three very specific, very important objectives per year, in which case I think that a conventional periodization with these large blocks of low intensity, high volume training, starting each block, it may work quite well. It also may work quite well when you are someone who is starting in the sport, whose, you know, actual fitness nowadays is quite poor, because by starting with this large volume but low intensity, normally you have a lower injury risk. But then again, in today's sports, athletes are competing 15, 20, 25 times per, even amateur athletes, at least that, no? So it is normal that they have several different relatively important objectives per year. In that cases, I think that the conventional periodization is quite difficult to implement, because you will end up with more or less important races in between, you know, blocks of training that are not specific to the race stimuli, etc. So in that cases, and especially if we are talking about already fit athletes, I do prefer a block periodization, even if, you know, I firmly believe that you can achieve success in almost any kind of endurance discipline with both types of periodization.
And how do you implement block periodization specifically? Because I think this is it's of course a term that everybody listening has heard. It comes up quite a lot, but I don't think everybody understands really how to implement it, or there are obviously different ways to implement it. But let's say you have a cyclist that has several different key races that are all important to them. Maybe one really important race in the spring, and one couple in the summer, and one in the fall. How do you then, if for that kind of cyclist, implement block periodization?
Yeah. So to implement it correctly, I like to take into account two factors, okay? First of all is whether something is very specific to the competition demand or not. And second, what's the detraining timing of the qualities that you are training with what you are attempting to train. I will put an example. Imagine that you, as you have said, you have a cyclist who is going to perform at several races during the year. You, because the evidence is quite there, you know that strength training in the gym is quite good for them, okay? So, but the fact is it very specific to the motion required during the competition? I would say no. How long does the detraining last when you stop strength training? Okay, so it's quite long. I mean, if you stop completely in the gym for a month, most of your adaptations will still be there. So that tells you something. Okay, just before the race, I don't need to train this because this is not very specific, and it can be stopped entirely, even far in advance. Okay. So these accumulation blocks during the ATRs can be used for that, for example. But you won't use this kind of stimulus during the realization phase, which is just before the competition, in which you prioritize specific actions and especially tapering before the competitions.
So how many weeks would you do specific race-specific training? And other than strength training, what would the blocks before the specific training look like?
Yeah, it depends a lot of basically how many races or how many relevant races, you know, the athlete has per year. But an average block, we're talking here about 8 to 10 weeks. The first month, more or less, could be accumulation, and then
When you say accumulation, explain what you mean by that.
I mean, not very competition specific work. For example, if we are talking about an MTB rider who will participate in a race that lasts an hour and a half, okay, he also needs to ride at lower intensities, okay? But when is that moment? For me, that, you know, that's what is said in the literature. The truth is that we don't really know, okay, when you should do it. But you know, this is more empirical, but I try to implement the non-specific work far in advance, because we also know that the adaptations of, you know, this high volume, low intensity work endure quite, not quite as much as the strength training adaptations, but still quite, you know, quite long. And we know that because of the studies performed with the training, okay? So this non-specific work is implemented normally during these accumulation phases. Then all the a little bit more specific and a lot more demanding work will be put in the transformation phase. And then the realization normally is just specific intensity bouts that will recreate what you will encounter in competition with plenty of recovery, which will be the tapering for the race. Yeah.
And if you have an athlete, like say an ultra cyclist, or you said that you coach ultra runners or Ironman athletes, people that are doing long races at lower intensities, then would you then use reverse periodization essentially, or how would you go about that?
In my experience, I have encountered the most success with this type of athletes performing, I would say, 98% of the work below the first threshold.
Okay.
Yeah. I have attempted several different strategies there, and the most evident one, the most, you know, surprisingly logical one for me is the one that works the most. Yeah, the best.
And why do you think that is? Not doubting it per se, but if you think about the model of performance in even in, let's say, an Ironman, you would still have VO2 max would be important, and fractional utilization at your performance VO2 and then economy. So you can make a case, or I think I can make a case for, you can get probably most of your economy training by at low intensities. You do get a lot of fractional utilization and even VO2 max training. But if you look at the research, then I would say that the research at least would indicate that you have to do some high intensity interval training to maximize your VO2 max potential. So that would go against the philosophy there of doing vast majority of the training at a low intensity.
Well, in this type of events, you can reach, you know, maximal potential with two different characteristics or strategies. Okay, and the 2% of work that I do with this at least is normally VO2 max. Okay, so I usually avoid completely threshold training. But in any case, and I last week I was talking with a very high performing Spanish marathon runner. We are talking here about 2 hours and 6 minutes in the marathon. Okay, and he has a surprisingly low VO2 max. What's the number? What do you think?
65.
66, 67, which, you know, normally when you are presented with the data, you would say, well, it's difficult to run as fast a marathon with that VO2 max, okay? But his gross efficiency is 26%, which is, you know, as surprising as encountering a VO2 max of plus 90, okay? So what I'm trying to tell you here is that in this type of events, I believe that making you as efficient as possible, even while your engine is not as powerful as possible, will get you to the same place. And also, I think that in this type of events, there is a survivor bias, at least from what I have seen, which is in cycling, at least, what kind of cyclists end up doing 12-hour marathons of 24-hour marathons in cycling. Not the ones who are performing the best in normal races.
Yeah, true.
That's a survival bias, which I believe is the case here. Okay, so you have people with quite, you know, modest VO2 max, probably quite modest second threshold, which, you know, won't allow him to perform well in more explosive, shorter races, 2-hour races, 4-hour races with, you know, high intensity, extreme intervals. But then when we are talking about riding at the same pace for 8, 10, 12 hours, he can perform quite well.
Yeah.
And at least, you know, this is my belief in these cases.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. I like that thinking, and it's, I think that's what's interesting, but it's, as you say, there are different ways to get to the same outcomes, but I'm on the one hand, I'm surprised to hear you say that, but also, yeah, there is quite a lot of logic to it, and really interesting that you have tried different methods and see the best results with such a low amount still of that higher intensity work. But I think it makes sense, like you said, that the 2% that you do, that's VO2 max training rather than threshold training, because you probably get, I mean, low intensity training will translate much better to improving your anything up the threshold, but maybe not
because in my experience, and sorry for interrupting you, in my experience in this kind of events, there are also other factors that are quite relevant that are normally not as well trained with, you know, high intensity work. I'm talking about psychological resilience, for example, you know, because if you have to ride for 8, 10, 12 hours at the same, even if it is relatively low intensity, but you have to ride at this intensity for 8, 10, 12 hours. By doing as much low intensity training and high volume as you can, you get quite well prepared for that. I think that there are many cases, specifically in triathlons, where people who are much more fit than they believe they are end up failing because of this psychological resilience.
Well, let's take one more topic from the list of topics here that I had that I wanted to talk about from both the science and the practice standpoint. And let's do threshold training. What do you think about this from a scientific perspective? Training at or around your second threshold in this is what we're referring to here. So, or FTP, critical power. And what about the practice of it all? Is that something that you use in coaching much or not so much?
Well, threshold as an intensity, yes, of course I use it as a, you know, training intensity distribution in which I prefer this intensity over others. Definitely no. I think that this is, you know, this intensity is quite expensive in terms of metabolic cost, so you need quite a lot of time to recover from it. And, well, I think that I told you before that from what I have seen in the scientific evidence, there's no clear evidence supporting that, you know, the distribution of intensity should be one or the other. The only clear evidence we have is that most of them spend most of their time at very easy intensity, okay? But, and this is just personal preference, I instead of spending most of the time at threshold, I prefer to, you know, use a little bit of threshold, but much more in what you would call the severe or especially extreme intensity domains, okay?
Which especially the extreme domain. Did you say that?
I said severe domain and all these glycolytic efforts, okay?
Yeah.
Zone 6, even zone 7, and 7 intensity zone, yeah. But that's personal preference. If I'm sure that you will ask, some of my colleagues, and they will answer differently. So,
yeah.
And I don't think that I'm being the most reasonable here, and neither they are. You know.
But what is your rationale for not using it that much by the sound of it, or at least compared to what many others are doing?
My empirical evidence says that this kind of sessions, threshold sessions, leave you so tired, at least from the feedback I obtain from my athletes, is that it leaves you so tired that it's difficult to even try to perform the next days a low intensity session correctly. Okay.
Do you think that has something to do with, this is my empirical evidence, that might have something to do with athlete phenotype? So somebody who is a bit more glycolytic, naturally a higher W prime, higher proportion of fast twitch fibers, even though I've never measured that with an athlete, so that's more of a guess.
Yeah, but we can discuss that if you want, because you know that, of course, it's interesting to calculate your critical power and W prime, but you know that the result you get with W prime depends a lot on how you test critical power.
Yes, it does. But when you always do it the same way, then at least you get consistent results for you and for your athletes.
Yes, but if you do two tests or three tests or four tests, okay, even if the result is the same in the absolute amount, okay, because you test with two tests or three tests consistently. Yep. You are profiling, and you know, without taking into account, probably because most of the people test critical power that way with two efforts or three efforts, you're not taking into account, you know, the right side of the curve, which may surprise you if you incorporate that in the equation of critical power, and try to do that, and you will see that the absolute kilojoule value that you get above critical power will be quite different, and if you chose one over the other, you will categorize the rider completely differently.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that the W prime is necessarily the most important measure either for categorization. I think you can just almost just tell when you get to know a rider or a triathlete by how they perform in different types of sessions, what their personal bests are in different durations on the power duration curve or different events. Like what is their 1500 PB if they've done a 1500 on track versus their 10K versus their marathon, you know, those sorts of things. So it can also be very more subjective. But yeah, my question comes back to, I think I see a trend where the people that are more fast twitch dominant, they're better on that shorter side of things, that they have a very high fatigue cost from threshold training. But the ones that are much more on the slow twitch side of things have a lower fatigue cost. That's not to say that it's insignificant and that it's the best, but I do think I see a kind of a polarized reaction to that type of training based on what the athlete profile is, regardless of how you use exactly how you profile the athlete.
Yeah. My answer also comes back to my previous answer, is that the problem with categorization, specifically with when we do them with type of fiber, is that to date, and even to date, we are not completely sure whether we can first really change type of fiber with predominant with training. And second, we don't even know exactly what happens at the level of recruitment with effort, especially after fatigue. So you can end up categorizing someone as fast twitch fiber, but if you took a muscle biopsy after 4 hours of effort, which we don't do, you could be quite surprised with the pattern of recruitment you get there. So I'm not, as you can see, I'm not a very, you know, huge fan of categories, because, and here I have to acknowledge my ignorance, but I'm, from the evidence I have seen to date, I'm not quite sure what happens there.
Well, how about this? Like, I also don't really care about the muscle fibers because I've never had any one of my athletes tested about the muscle fiber. But if you talk about a steep power duration curve, somebody who can perform really well at short durations versus a slow power duration curve. So we're just looking at the performance outcomes. Is that a valid way of profiling athletes? And do you think that a different, profiling athletes in that way, potentially you get insights into what type of training they might respond to?
Well, we're talking about a durability curve, I guess, here.
No, just a normal power duration. Well, I guess it's implicit, but just a power duration curve in general. And I guess normally a lot of people don't have very valid max efforts when you go into long durations. But so you see more information, I think, in the first 20, 30, 60 minutes.
Yeah, the problem is that for the first testing, I use that, but afterwards, what you are interested in is what the performance that he will try to achieve in the specific demand of the competition, which is, depends a lot of the race you're training for. But at the end of the day, I'm not as interested as, in his 5 minute power in fresh state when we are attempting to win the Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Okay.
Yep.
So yeah, it's good. It's good. You have improved that. But, I believe that you must test always. If you are attempting to win or compete in a specific race, you have to test under racing conditions. Okay. So I'm always preferably interested in what happens in these conditions. So no, I wouldn't say I profile that way and select the preferred training, distribution based on what I see on the initial power curve. No.
Okay. Moving on then, you had a lot of interesting topics in your book. So I'm going to let you choose one that you think the listeners will find really interesting and share some of your thoughts on that and especially some key practical takeaways.
Well, there are 32 different chapters in the book, so in lots of talking about training, but I will choose one specific topic that is not as much about training as it is about life decisions. So I will talk about opportunity cost, which has his own chapter in the book. Okay, so every endurance athlete has to, decide what to do, where to spend his money, and all these kind of decisions that are, you cannot go back. So if you decide to spend most of your time training in zone 2, you cannot reverse that and after 6 months try to, change completely your prioritization. It won't work. If you have $2,000 to spend, you can spend them on a new bicycle or a new set of wheels, but won't get again this €2,000 to spend on another thing. No, so this concept of opportunity cost, it's very important, especially for the amateur, because as we understand it, the pro has unlimited time and money to spend on all sports-related stuff. And I think that the opportunity cost is super important for the amateurs because they have, it depends on the case, but most of them have huge time restriction and most of them have also, monetary restriction. And I will, for instance, I will put an example. If a guy comes to me and, bought his first bike yesterday and wants to train, I will say to him that I prefer that he doesn't start working with me and I prefer to use his first $200 to spend it on a biomechanical study because this will make him ride, comfortable. He will enjoy riding. He will put on the miles and after 3, 4, 5, 6 months, he will get much stronger than if I, train him for several weeks. So this is just a simple example of what's the meaning of the opportunity cost. No, so tell me your ingredients. Let's do the best recipe with it. And this specific chapter in the book talks about that in each one of the moments that you have in your sporting career.
Yeah, no, that's great.
What to do in which moment to make the best out of your time and money.
Yeah, I think that's really a really great lens to look at things from. And I think in triathlon, we have maybe even more examples of that because, for example, a common issue for amateur athletes is that they're not that fast swimmers, but the swim is a very short proportion of the race. So how much time do you spend learning how to swim when it's also so technically difficult and it's so hard to make significant improvements? And it's a lot easier to, for most people, to make significant improvements on the bike and the run. That's an example. That's maybe an example, or the way I gave it there, it's a bit leading or very leading. If you, you can probably guess kind of what I think for in a general case there, what makes sense to do. But I mean, there, you can have much, other examples to that as well. Like strength training is one example for sure that, as you mentioned, in cycling and in triathlon as well, it's something that can be very useful. But how useful is it compared to if you're training for an Ironman and you have limited time and you need to put in the miles? Then that becomes a question that you need to weigh quite carefully.
Yeah, because the 2 hours that you spend strength training, you're not riding your bike or you're not running.
Yeah.
That's what this chapter is about.
All right. Let me see here which question to do next. So I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. You already alluded to this one, your ideal PhD program. You kind of answered the question, but if you answer it again, if you could design an ideal PhD program, so that would consist of multiple studies where you try to really move training knowledge, training science forward, what would you do?
I think that we have two very important questions that remain unanswered. One is whether slightly different intensities produce different adaptations, okay, over time or over long time periods, because as I explained before, you know, in science we are very limited in the amount of time we can spend performing a study, because you have to recruit people who are willing to train the way you tell them, which, by the way, is not the best way to train for them. Okay, but they have to do that for 2 or 3 months, and they have to, you know, do it religiously. So, you know, if you can achieve a sample of 30, 40, yeah, it's extraordinary in sports science. You know, so imagine if you need to a sample of 300 subjects and you need 9 months for an intervention. It's an entire season in which they will be working probably not the, you know, the best way they could. So it's quite difficult to get people to volunteer to that kind of study. But if I had unlimited amount of money and subjects and time, I would definitely test at different training intensities over a very long period and see what happens at the level of central and peripheral adaptations. I'm talking here about what happens at a cardiac level, what happens at a muscular level, okay, after a long time. And also whether there are really great changes in performance, you know, but we have discussed this before, no? Whether you're riding at 180 watts or you're riding at 205 watts, okay?
So which groups would you... if you had unlimited subjects, so how would you set up the different groups of intensities? Because you said you want to do them very close to each other, but maybe if you also want to compare people doing only low-intensity training with some people that are more focused on like high-intensity training, would you always have a baseline of low-intensity training in the program? Like you do your base, I don't know, 10 hours a week of easy.
No, because that would contaminate the study, because you get adaptations from the low intensity training. I will just use intervals of that specific zone. Mm-hmm. For me, the most interest is located just below the first threshold and just above. Okay, because the zone one in power zones is completely irrelevant. I mean, we already know that this active recovery doesn't, you know, it's not stay at home, you know, watch a movie, but you don't have to go out and drive for an hour. So we are talking about zone 2 in power zones and zone 3, you know, so just this surrounding this first threshold. And also I would love to see a comparison between threshold work and, you know, above critical power. So we are talking about zone 5. That will be the most interest for me, yeah.
And how would you, by the way, I'm going to come back to that question about, or that thing about zone one, because I want to hear more about that. But would you control the training in these different intensities by kilojoules, or just how would you have any kind of control there, or what would the control be?
You have to make it relative to their, how do you say, internal load in these cases. Okay.
So how do you do that relative to internal load?
As you do with training, first, perception of effort, second, which is available to all athletes, heart rate, and third, power, and see whether it matches, because you will have at least that report an RPE of 6 over 10 in a zone 1 plus, which doesn't make any sense. Okay, so you have to see that it matches. But in general, most of the studies that I performed before with this kind of interventions, we did it with power output and monitoring for heart rate.
But is there a way that you make sure that you control for variables like, well, the group that trained in zone 2, they did more kilojoules or more hours than the group that trained in zone 4 or zone 5?
Of course, if you're training in zone 2, for example, and you weigh more, normally your power output will also be higher. So you know, the kilojoules will also higher, but that you have to relativize it to your own level and to your own, in this case, weight. Okay. So I think that is not very relevant. It's like when we started to monitor durability with kilojoules, it was quite funny because, you know, it was like after 3,000 kilojoules, what happens? Yeah, but it's not the same 3,000 for a guy who weighs 50 kilos, who has been in the, you know, riding max power in the flat for 4 hours before Mont Ventoux, than the guy who is 75 kilos, who, you know, is riding in zone 2 plus.
Yeah.
So that's important to relativize it. Yeah.
And you said you had theories for what you think might happen with things like the cardiovascular adaptations, the muscular adaptations. So what are your theories?
My theory, at least surrounding this first ventilatory threshold, imagine that we get, it won't happen, but if we could get it, I guess that after 8 or 9 months of intervention, you will get quite similar results. Quite similar. I mean, maybe there's statistical significance, but when you look at the effect size.
Yeah. Well, that's what I would also think. And that's where, because if the intensity is similar, then yeah, the threshold is maybe a bit of a, it leads people to think that something is drastically different on one than the other. But yeah, that's questionable, at least from an empirical.
Yeah, but even, you know, if you're even riding at 180 watts versus 210, you know, it gets quite, you know, it gets much harder, specifically after, you know, after several hours. So you could believe that you know, the amount of work you have performed will result in much greater adaptations. But still, with this difference in mind, I still believe that the outcome in performance will be quite similar.
Well, that's why I would ask about controlling for kilojoules, even though there are also limitations to that, but or kilojoules per body weight, perhaps. But
yeah, per body weight, yeah. It's the same as when you monitor for fatigue, okay? Yeah.
Because if you...
Either do it with a metric that is relativized to your level, which could be even TSS, okay? Or monitor it relativized to your body weight, but not with an absolute metric for people who are vastly different.
Yeah, because you might ride for 6 hours at 180 watts, but 5 hours at 210 watts, and then even though you, the extra duration would even out perhaps the energy you spend output, and then also perhaps the training effects. But that's what would be interesting to study for sure.
Yeah.
So coming back to that question about zone one, then, or you said that it's pointless. You should stay on the couch instead. So I think that's going to
that are not my words. Eh? That are words of Stephen Saylor.
Oh, is it?
And I completely agree with him.
Yeah. Explain why.
Because one thing is subjective recovery, okay? And another very vastly different thing is objective recovery, which is one and which is the other. The subjective recovery is how you feel, okay? It's the same as with all these recovery methods used by the pros, which have no evidence so far. Massage, for example, okay? If you and we have studies on this, if you perform a test and then after the training session you get a massage or you get a active recovery, and the day after you perform another test, the guys who got the massage or who did the active recovery will say that they felt less fatigued or, you know, less pain or whatever you want. But the results of the test, the power output was the same. The heart rate was the same, etc. So, you know, and here we are coming back to this cost opportunity, okay? I don't care if you, you know, in your free day, you want to ride your bike for an hour in zone one. If it makes you feel better, it's the same as if you get a massage. I don't care. If it makes you feel better, that's okay. But you won't perform better by doing so. And you're wasting 1 hour of your time, or you are wasting 60 euros in a massage and going to the other side of the city to get the massage, okay, to make you feel better. So it's your decision. But so far, from what we have seen, and, you know, you don't get any adaptation from training in zone one, and you don't get any recovery specific in terms of active recovery by doing, you know, your rides or runs. Is not common doing a run in zone one, but, you know, performing your sessions in zone one.
Yeah. I mean, devil's advocate here. I agree in some ways and I disagree in other ways. One example there is that I think in cycling, it does make quite a lot of sense. I think it makes more sense than in triathlon and in running. A, because in running, the biomechanical stress is just completely different. So there, I think anecdotally, you see that still, like, a lot of runners do use zone one because to stay injury free for one thing. But, and in triathlon, I think it's more that the overall training volume is so high that you're limited by energy output and energy intake. And in cycling, yeah, you don't have one of those limitations. So I think it makes sense that more of your training, your endurance training, can be in zone two. But my one devil's advocate argument there would be, what if you, especially for an amateur, you're not as well trained as the pros, you don't have all the time you don't have all the opportunities to recover. You might still have a very good FTP. Let's say you're at 340 watts for your FTP, but you have a weekend ride and you have the opportunity to go out and ride for 6 hours. So should you then ride for 6 hours at least what is 60% of 340 watts? That's, let's say, 210 plus watts to 55%, at least 210 watts. But
yeah, if with an FTP of 340, you said?
Yeah, 340, yeah. Now,
Let's say at least 190 watts in that case. Yeah, 190, 200
yeah,
watts.
Right, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Would you do that even for a very long ride? Or would you think that that's very important? Or I'm not saying that you should go out and I also don't think that you should go out and do that for at 140 watts. But I guess as a coach, what would I do there? I would probably just say go out and ride. And then they might end up riding at 170 or 200, 210. And I don't, whatever they do, it's fine, really. But it's more the duration that is the stimulus there rather than the intensity itself.
Well, I have done quite some experiments with different type of results, but one of those experiments was, you know, riding at these extremely low intensities for many hours as a means for attempting training for ultra distance in cycling. And normally you would expect, you know, at the intensities we have talked before, in the case of this guy you commented, 180, 200 watts at least, after several hours, you will get at least some cardiac drift, for example, or his RPE will be higher progressively, etc. And what I got after riding for 7 hours at 150 watts, it was something like that, there wasn't even cardiac drift. So, you know, do you really think that it's the best use of your time to write, you know, 5-6 hours at that intensity, even if that was the case, that it produced any kind of adaptation?
And
I talk specifically about active recovery, yeah, which is you have your free day. In my advice in that case will be stay at home.
Okay. I agree with that. I'm not talking about active recovery, no. I'm talking about endurance training in general, your low intensity training, where, for example, how I name my power zones, I don't call it zone one, active recovery. I call it easy endurance, and I call zone two, steady endurance. So there's even a difference there. And for example, for a triathlete, let's say they have done a hard longer run in the morning, and then I wanted to do a two-hour ride in the evening, then usually I would make that a zone one ride. It's not, the purpose is not active recovery, because then I agree it would be sit on the couch. The purpose is to accumulate volume. It's to still stimulate endurance adaptations.
Yeah, but in a double session, probably what you will get because of what was induced by this first session of the day, probably what you will get is maybe an external load. You are in this easy endurance, as you call it. But probably if you ask about internal metrics associated to this, you know, external load will be quite higher.
Okay.
So I guess maybe specifically about central adaptations, maybe we are getting something there.
Okay. Yeah. No, I just wanted to...
I was talking about active recovery.
Okay.
Yeah. If you have 1 hour of your time, please don't ride in zone one. Stay at home. If you only want to recover, stay at home.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. That's why I completely removed the term active recovery, almost completely removed active recovery from my vernacular, because I just think that passive recovery is better than active recovery.
There is activity or recovery, but not both.
yes. I want to ask one more question about more related to science and more so on the, perhaps more theoretical or academic side of things. But I had, and it was quite an interesting episode that a lot of listeners commented on, Joe Warren on, who talked about the replication issues that they have found in sports science, and that is not unique to sports science, but also in other fields. And basically, well, his message was also that it doesn't mean that you should throw the science out and that it isn't good and or that all of it is bad or anything like that. But what is your take on that? Have you been following that discussion, and how would you view it?
Well, first of all, I would like to highlight that in general, in sciences in which we work with human subjects, it is quite difficult to replicate findings, because in engineering, for example, we are talking about mathematical calculations, you know, when there is innovation, you know, it's quite easy to replicate and obtain the same results the other guy in the other side of the world obtained. But it may happen to even the same researcher that you get quite different results performing the same experiment on the same sample twice. So imagine if another guy from another part of the world with another tools tries to replicate, you know, what you did, but with another sample. It gets messy. So this will happen, even happens with drugs testing. Okay, with pharmaceutical companies, depending on the sample, from where is the sample, you will get better or worse results with the drug, etc. So it's not a novelty that it happens to us. But again, and that's why I always emphasize that as for the conservative findings, which is the ABC, I think that the knowledge we have obtained over several decades is it's quite good. But when you try to reach a single subject with that knowledge, you have to apply it to his own context. And that's why I think that, of course, you can and you will get great results in your first year working with someone if you work quite well. But the best part of your job starts after you know him quite well, because now you can apply, you know, modulate your knowledge to that specific case. And there are no two similar cases in terms of timetable, in terms of other stuff they are doing with their life, etc. So you have to know the ABC which has been provided over these decades. You have to know how to interpret the results. And I think that that's also important, that if you can, it is good if you help in the production of scientific evidence, because by producing papers, you must read all the available literature, because you have to cite it, and you learn a lot how to interpret the findings and relativize some of them, as I previously explained, for example, with this paper with torque training in cycling.
Yeah, that's good. And definitely makes sense, right? It does highlight that you cannot just go and read a couple of abstracts and then use that to do some kind of science-based training. So,
Because, sorry for interrupting, but in my book, for example, there are like 25 cases in which the conclusion is, we don't know. So these are the facts as we know them today. Probably if I write the same book after 5 years, it will be different. But the knowledge reached this, and I explain, you know, we have these possibilities. We currently do not know if this or, for example, the periodization, we do not know which one is better. So you have to tell it.
Yeah. But would you advise coaches and especially coaches that are using, they're reading the science, they're trying to stay up to date on it, but would you advise them to be cautious with applying things directly if it's a topic that hasn't been studied so much? And I guess you already kind of answered it, but I'm asking the question again to clarify.
Well, first of all, you have to, it's okay if it has been published in a journal, but you have to see where has it been published, because it's not the same, you know, like a first quartile journal versus, you know, some kind of journal in which you can pay and publish everything you want. Okay, so there are differences there. Then even after that, there's a pyramid of evidence, of knowledge. Okay, so the summit of everything would be a meta-analysis of a meta-analysis. Okay, so it's like a compendium of the average results of multiple studies over the time. Okay, once you get that, which by the way in our field it's not that common to have a meta-analysis or anything, you can be fairly sure that at least what is said there, you won't encounter the contrary on the empirical, you know, field. So normally it will be maybe not B, but A or C, but it won't be W, okay?
Yeah. I mean, one example with you said about the journals not all being the same. The recent example that came up is the study about from Tim Noakes and colleagues with carbohydrates and suggesting that 10 grams of carbs per hour could basically be a similar performance level as higher carb intakes. And that article was published in Endocrine Reviews. It wasn't published in a sports science journal. So, and given especially who reviews these articles, it's people that review them are not paid to review it, right? So, yeah. And if it's somebody who is a reviewer for Endocrine Reviews, they're not going to have the knowledge necessarily, or probably not, about sports science and the field of sports at all. So from a just purely metabolic physiological perspective, what is written in the article might make sense. And that's maybe why an article like that can, I'm not saying that it wouldn't have been published in sports science art journals, but it makes it a bit easier to get, you can basically get anything published that you want in one way or another.
I must be the devil's advocate here. I'm not a big fan of Tim Noakes, but the truth is that he has published, you know, several very relevant papers over time, not as related to our field as to endocrinology in general. But I do think it is a good paper, and I do think that it is an interesting and well-founded perspective, which, you know, it's contrary to what we are believing currently. But in some sense, it's complementary. And I think that it is important that, you know, the truth is not set in stone here, okay? And probably somewhere in the middle, probably, as most of the times, okay? So I think that it is important that relevant people are putting their perspective on the picture out there. And I'm not surprised that it was published, because I do believe it's a good study. even if I disagree with some of the stuff is there inside there. But I do think it's a good study and an interesting and different perspective. So I would be upset if it wasn't published, because the main reasoning behind sports nutrition is against what Tim believes currently. Okay, and we can get the same about cholesterol, for example, in medicine and the role of statins, etc. If you go with the mainstream belief, you can get published very easily. But if you try to put in the light a different theory, it's much more difficult. I do believe that different theories, if they are substantiated in, you know, good facts, must be put out there to be criticized. But, you know.
That's fair. I think, though, that it would be better if those studies were still reviewed by reviewers, were like in an actual sports science journal. It doesn't have to be, you know, the top one or top two, but I think that would be better for the credibility of the study. But I think that's a good perspective.
To tell you the truth, I do not know who was the reviewer.
I don't know either. I'm making some assumptions there.
Yeah, but you know, that's another topic. But the fact is that I'm a reviewer for several of the mainstream, you know, journals in our field, and the fact is that you spend an enormous amount of time working completely free. Okay, so at the end of the day, it's normal that it's difficult to get people to review studies if, you know, journals are making quite a huge amount of money and we are getting nothing.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. No, it's clearly an issue. But maybe that's something that to not solve on this podcast, because that's not really what the main topic of this show is about. Let's finish off with something more practical. What are two things that listeners can implement that will improve their performance on the bike and that they most likely haven't thought about? So this excludes things like the usual answers that we get, which are consistency and sleep and those sorts of things.
Yeah. Well, one that is not as commonly discussed as sleep or nutrition or, you know, training, supplementation with vitamin D, okay? That's one thing that it's strange, tell you the truth, because when you think about endurance athletes, you are thinking about people who are healthy, athletic, young, trained, and especially normally quite exposed to the sun, okay? And what I get systematically is people who are spending 6 hours per day riding their bike or running out there in the mountains with the deficiency in vitamin D, okay? So please test for it. And if you have a deficiency, which is quite common, especially, I believe most of your viewers will be from the Northern Hemisphere and live in latitudes in which they don't get a lot of sun exposure. So test for it, because you may get surprised. And if you know, this is already medical advice, but normally you should supplement. Because, and we have a fair amount of evidence highlighting that its role in recovery, but also in mood modulating properties, which is very important for general life, but also for your sportive life. And that's, you know, talking about opportunity cost, which is something completely cheap and easy to implement and can result in great gains, especially if you are deficient. That will be one. And the other, and I think that is the biggest mistake people in general are doing there out there, is that they are trying to adapt their life to their training. And it should be vice versa. So what's your life like this? Adapt your objectives and your training to these circumstances. So if you have a family, if you have a full-time job, maybe it's not the most logical step to try to prepare for a 24-hour ultra-distance cycling event and try to perform your best there, okay? Because the amount of time you have to spend training for that event is contrary to your obligations in your real life. So see how are your circumstances, decide starting from there, and maybe this kind of objective is the most reasonable, and this kind of training for this kind of objective is the most appropriate for my circumstances. And that strategy normally results in the best outcomes in the long term, in the most satisfaction, and especially in the most adherence to training. Because if you try to prepare for an event that is a mismatch to your lifestyle, you may last 2 months or 4 months or 6 months, but you won't last six seasons doing that. That would be my advice.
I missed parts of your answer there due to some connection issues. I think that will be all good in the final version, because the audio and video should be recorded locally and then uploaded to the cloud, so I can download that after we finished the interview. But I didn't hear most of it, so I'm looking forward to hearing it. But I won't ask you to repeat it. Just one comment on the vitamin D answer is that it's also been linked to bone stress injuries or deficiency in vitamin D. So for people doing running, that's yet another reason to, as you say, get it checked. And yeah, most people probably do need supplementation. Yeah, I think that's great, Sebastian. Thank you for taking the time. Thank you for a lot of good discussions, good thoughts and perspectives. And just to finish off, where can the listeners find and follow you and your work?
Yeah, you can find me at my website, shitcotraining.com, and also my social media, which are all called Shitco Training. And don't forget to buy the book, even if you are a triathlete, because, you know, 80% of the knowledge there will also apply to you. So I think that's an interesting read for all of you, all of your listeners.
So that's shitcotraining.com. I'll put the links in the show notes. Thank you so much. It was great to chat, and hope to see you again another time.
Thank you, Michael. See you all. Bye.
I hope that you enjoyed that episode. You can find the show notes, as usual, on scientifictriathlon.com. And in the podcast description, in your podcast app, you can find a bunch of links and related episodes and resources. And also, I want to give you a quick reminder that the best way for you to give me feedback on what episodes you like, which episodes you dislike, and which ones are somewhere in the middle, Just use the poll function in Spotify. For each episode, I put up a poll, which gives you the options to rate the episode. So just rate it there, and this way I can see which episodes are well received, which ones not so much, and that way I can figure out more quantitatively which episodes the listenership like and dislike. So that's super helpful if you can do that. Just take it as a habit if you're already listening on Spotify. Of course, if you're listening on other platforms, keep sending me feedback or emails, or use the YouTube comments and DMs, even though I tend to try to not read the DMs because I get too much spam there. But so that's maybe the worst option. And then just to finish the episode, I want to share a case study of an athlete who's been working with us at Scientific Triathlon for quite a number of years as a coached athlete. And this case study is of this athlete improving his 20-minute power on the bike from 305 watts when he started with us in his late 40s to 373 watts in his mid-50s, which I think is a brilliant example of that old adage of how we tend to overestimate what we can do in 1 year, but underestimate what we can do in 5 or 10. Because I think this is very true for almost all of us, that we tend to get stuck at a level well below our true potential because of trying to achieve too much in a short amount of time. And instead, we don't achieve anywhere near our full potential over a long period of time because of this lack of patience leading to incorrect training processes, incorrect training structure, and focusing on the wrong things. And yeah, that then limits very much what we can achieve over the long term. So that's a case study. That's obviously something that hopefully makes you want to consider our coaching. If you are somebody who's looking to improve your triathlon performance, you want to take it to the next level, you're committed to improvement and achieving goals, then check out our coaching on scientifictriathlon.com/coaching. If coaching is not for you, if it's out of your budget, or you prefer to have the reins yourself, but you still feel that some objective and external support would be helpful, then we have other options like ready-made training plans is a great option, especially on a tighter budget. But also we have consultations, we have customized training plans. So there's something for everybody. Go and check out how we can help you on scientifictriathlon.com. We would love to support you on your journey. All right, so that's it for today. If you have any questions or feedback, please email me on michael@scientifictriathlon.com. And that's Michael with a K. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.